they've been used for centuries, you know, pots and the whole concept of a vessel has been used throughout human history.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, art, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm one of the authors of the book The Curious Advantage. And I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, the renowned artist Dame Magdalena Odunde. Kenyan-born, British-based, Chancellor of the University for the Creative Arts, Dame Magdalena is a potter whose pots sit in many of the most important collections and galleries around the world. Beautiful, sinuous, amorphous in shape, the pots are vehicles for thinking. Informed by Attic, African, and Cycladic forms, they challenge and they inspire. And in this episode of The Curious Advantage, we are confronted by an artist. In the book, we talk about how artists inspire us and cause us to look at the world differently. This can be disquieting and this can be life-changing. Dame Magdalena does all of that and more in this fascinating conversation. It is wide-ranging and explores many of the seven C's of curiosity. We explore context, construction, and the power of making. We explore learning from doing, criticality, and we learn how Dame Magdalena understands the world through her practice of making. On reflections, in many ways, this conversation is poetic. Artists really make us look at the familiar with new eyes. I encourage you to search for the pots of Magdalena Odunde online, and please enjoy this conversation. Hello, Magdalena.
Hello. Great to join you.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. Honestly, I've wanted to talk with you for so long. I want to ask you about your pots. I've got three pots in particular, but the first one I want to ask you about is an orange pot, which you had in the Hepworth Wakefield exhibition, which was called The Journey of Things. And to me, this pot, she is feminine like a queen. She has a sort of crown to me. That's what I see. What do you see in this pot? Do you see your pots in that way?
I think pots, I think vessels, I think of the potency of a pot as a container, but also as a vehicle that allows, you know, containment, and also it pours. So it also, you know, you can actually pour out ideas, but also, you know, material matter that can sustain life, because the whole notion of a container was to use it as a vessel to contain food, to cook. But it has, I think for me, it has that notion of inside and outside. It's almost like it's like a home. And when you think about, you know, sort of the our species, but also other species who make containers, who make vessels, insects plus, you know, anthills, for example, they all gnaw into this and build using clay around just to have a chamber that they are in. And then they get out a chamber that contains them, protects them, and allows them that restful few hours of night or day. And then they come out to forage and to seek those materials beyond those confines to sustain them and bring them and cook them again. And you know, it's you know, pots mediate between that void space and that solid space and then the enclosed space. Yes. They've been used for centuries, you know, parts and the whole concept of a vessel has been used throughout human history for various things, for religious purposes, for transition from one area to another. They've been used as burial pieces. They've been used as pieces that are taken with you after you've died, as yes. is discovered in Egyptology, but in any excavation in any society. But you get me on a subject that I really love talking about, everything else other than the pots themselves.
Yes. Well, you know, you talk about them being the vessels and the containers and being used in history. And if you think of the mythology, the representation of goddesses, often the great goddesses have a pot with them.
Yes.
And they, you know, those representations, the idea of the mother, you talked about the home, the container, the idea of the matrix.
Yes.
The feminine, of course, the need to contain and create the world, which is what our mothers do for us. And they hold everything that's maternal. Do you share these ideas?
Totally, totally. I mean, one of the major influences for me, of course, is the female figure.
Yes.
Because, you know, sort of I was going to say the whole notion of a vessel for me is akin to a woman. And I know some people will say, well, not only women can carry children these days, because of technology. But for sure. me, the female figure, particularly when it's full and pregnant, you know, sort of it gives you that feeling of humanity because that body is carrying another life. And she is walking very much like a princess or a queen or whatever one wants to call it, like a goddess.
Very beautiful, that form.
Yes, when you watch a woman who's pregnant walking up and down perhaps a stairwell, and one of the biggest influences was for me to see this wonderful young girl absolutely pregnant walking, you know, sort of up a staircase at a train station with her sort of this wonderful, carrying this wonderful pregnancy and walking tall with her hair tied back into a ponytail like a ballerina, like a dancer in a dance in an African contest. Like, you know, you see these wonderful headdresses that women wear in, you know, sort of South Africa, yes. East. Woman bedecked with jewelry in Kenya amongst yes. the Maasai, and they're pregnant at the same time. And they have to walk tall, and then sometimes they're carrying a pot on their head. So just imagine that power that this container is walking around in. You can't yes. but crown that image.
Yes.
Into one of the most glorious, most amazing,
noble
sculptural art piece in itself. It's so perfect. But the idea also that this particular red piece of work, that this terracotta piece you mentioned, that idea of having this, containing this power in its, you know, sort of round pot, the belly pot, the stomach pot, and then the yes. neck, you know, sort of tightening that which has been contained, and then just opening to release yes. it very slowly. It is like imagining somebody raising themselves on their tiptoes, on their toes, and then imagining that transferring into the stomach, into the container, and being released through the neck and through the head and through the crown.
That's very beautiful. I mean, there is a rhythm in the form of your pots. There is a movement, a dynamic of energy, which I see as you describe it to me. Do you have a view on curiosity and what is curiosity for you?
You know, if I wasn't curious, I wouldn't be making what I what I make.
Yeah.
I'm so curious to get on to the next one, but I'm very curious to know what my neighbor is thinking and saying. I'm very curious to really know what my ancestors are thinking of from the other side. And it's that keeps us going. And I think it's important when you're teaching, particularly, I spent many years in my life teaching.
Mm.
And being with people from rising 5 to 60 odd or 70, you know, working as an educator, the idea of curiosity, the idea of instilling, questioning of material and the world we live in is just so important because it enables us to manifest that curiosity into tangible outcomes.
So is there so in the act of making it, does the narrative emerge in through the act of making? It's not the narrative that comes first, but the act of making it is what creates the story. Am I understanding that?
I think there is the period of the thinking, the working out a notional situation in which you lead yourself to the making process. So drawing is very important for me. Reading is very important for me. Being able to understand before I embark on the making is very crucial. While I'm making, these other notions, these other isms, these, whether it's religious, references, whether it's references to the other artists or reference to historical material artifacts, you know, will come in, because this period of making takes me quite a while to actually realize before the piece has arrived at a status in which I can kind of say, well, this is the best I can do with that piece of work. I'm going to take it beyond the raw clay, let it stiffen, let it dry, and then I'm going to put it in the kiln. And once you've put the clay into a kiln, it converts at a fairly early stage at about 600 degrees centigrade, and it becomes ceramics. There's no return because it doesn't actually become clay again. You can add it to clay, but it's gone. It's transfixed. And that's why, clay has always been a medium in which to read what was made before in historical and archaeological terms. It's a very important material. It's a very important object.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that? How you say it helps you read what came before?
Well, it's history. Once you've made a pot or you've made a thing, it becomes an object that is historical. It informs us, me, and everyone what it is to be human, because somebody made that piece of work, and it will tell the time in which the piece was made. It will tell what it was made for, and it can give you an indication of what is to come.
That's fascinating.
And I think this is why, and the fact that clay or ceramics and pottery can be excavated and exist intact to tell you that history is a fascinating thing. Archaeologists love it, and you know they love finding shards much more than finding a whole piece of work, because they can, you know, sort of count the little particles that are in the clay. They can tell you exactly what kind of material was used and what was even cooked in this piece, just from a shard of clay. And the shards exist much more than other objects.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I think you can find bronzes and all these things, but If you go to any museum, pottery is...
It's the pottery that remains.
That remains, right. Yes.
Exactly. You have another pot, another orange pot. I don't know why I'm attracted to the orange ones, because the black ones are also amazing. But you have another orange pot that is more masculine, or is it telling a more masculine story? It's a round pot with two holders on the side, and then it has a kind of... a phallus, perhaps, but it is not overtly so, but it is more of a extended pot that comes out. I mean, I see a cockerel in it, that kind of power. But, I mean, what is this pot telling you?
I think, yes, it has, you know, so pots can be very erotic, and pots can be very sensuous, as you mentioned before. And by nature, when you're making a pair of works, there is that inclination to have a female and male. It's to balance the world. And I like the notion of a balanced world. The fact that within the culture that I come from, the African culture, we had the notion of balance on earth, but balance through the ancestral spirits on the other side, worked together. You had to work with those ancestral spirits on the other side. So you had to work with both male and female, because they existed on the other world, on the other side, to enhance and to protect the living, to please the living, or to appease the living and to please the dead.
Yes.
And so a whole lot of ritual was centered around the making of pots, making of containers that were not necessarily a burial containers, but they contained the spirit of the present, but also the future.
You've got a very particular approach to glazing as well. I mean, there's a black pot of yours, which I love, which also has a kind of feminine ear, like, which is bent, as you say, which kind of projects out of the pot. How did you come to your glazing? Because it reminds me of Attic pots from Greece, ancient, and so on. That amazing sheen you get on it.
The pieces are not glazed at all. I don't use glazes. And I discovered this fairly later on when I was at the Royal College of Art, when I was making a decision to continue to hand build my work rather than use the wheel.
Yeah.
And I started, I was experimenting. I did use glaze, and the very early pieces from my undergraduate days have an element of glazing. But I found that with glazing, you need to fire the work at a higher temperature. And it's a different process. The clay becomes a little bit more stone, you know, stoneware-like, but it also, the pieces are fried. They are overcooked. Whereas I'm much more interested in the form, in what a pot says, what a vessel says. I'm interested in them being individuals and being, an easier word to use is sculptural. I don't particularly buy into the difference between, you know, sculpture and ceramics. They're all, you know, sort of pieces to dwell, to think with and to think. I can't explain that. But what I do, you know, with the pots, with my work, I first, you know, I burnish the work, but I also use what has come to be called terra sigillata, which is a form of slip, a colloidal slip, or a solution, a watery substance with clay, with a suspension of very, very fine particles of clay that when you use it as a coating, it adds this, you know, a sheen.
Yes.
To it. And then when you actually fire them in second or third firings to carbonize the pieces, the flame and the minerals in the clay react to each other to create a lustery quality. But it was more, it for me, it was more to do with practical solution, a means of just having a coating to protect the work,
yes,
rather than to render them non-porous. Glazes, yes, are usually were discovered basically to enable us to use pots for utilitarian purposes.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag Curious Advantage and join the conversation.
I'm really curious about your story. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to pottery and how you ended up where you are today?
Long story, 40 years on, I guess. Applied to a foundation course in Cambridge, because at the time we just really not long had independence in Kenya, and our education system was still attached to the British Oxbridge type of education. So came, you know, sort of Cambridge came to mind because I knew we knew a friend who was working there. And so I came in 1971 mainly to pursue further studies or to pursue a career in advertising and in commercial art. I think I started having a great time in Cambridge, meeting a whole lot of people, both from the Africa diaspora, at the different universities, and then just working away with fellow students on the foundation course, basically what it was called a foundation course in preparation for art college.
Mm.
And it was a 2-year course. And I started doing printmaking and ceramic pottery and jewelry and started exploring museums and with a very good friend of mine, who we both ended up in Farnham, and she ended up doing jewelry. I ended up doing pottery rather than commercial art.
Amazing.
I happened to like pottery, so I started taking pottery, evening pottery classes with a teacher, a lady called Zoe Elson, who happened to have been born in Zimbabwe. And she encouraged me. And, you know, when I started really feeling dissatisfied with commercial art, because knowledge is an amazing tool, I started realizing that advertising was what it was, a commercial art business. And really, I wasn't interested in filling people's minds with articles and items that they weren't able to afford it, in a material sense. And I started wondering what I was going to do. And it's my pottery teacher who said, well, maybe you should go to art college and instead of doing a BTEC commercial course, go to art school where you'd have an option of academic and practical course. So I ended up at Farnham.
Amazing.
Yeah. But it is a really long story. I mean, I'd have to write a book about it.
You should. But the thing that strikes me is like how powerful those foundation courses are. And when you think about any point in our lives, the idea of going into a situation where we keep things open and get tasting menus and can have a taste of all the different things that are available, it's incredibly powerful to help us find the things that really float our boat, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you know what, Garrick? I think the sad thing about today is that negation of a liberal arts education. The beauty about the liberal arts environment that I found myself in at Cambridge was that you could actually mingle with people from the other universities who are doing purely academic subjects.
Yeah.
And within the art school itself, you could literally have your options, but you could dip into the other options whenever you had the opportunity. And if you were somebody who was very motivated like myself, and didn't need any encouragement to try everything, you just went wild with it.
Openness in society.
Yes.
And how, if you're just down a single track, a student who decides to go into just, you know, business and management and, say, accounting, you know, there was a time where kids could do that, having had a liberal arts degree and having had an experience of things that were much broader and wider and interesting, which is what I think college and university should be about.
Well, exactly.
It makes for more interesting adults, my view.
Yeah. And, you know, we used to have those years when people went in to do PPE, you know, politics, and or did anthropology and archaeology, and then ended up as being great teachers or great painters and great art historians or politicians, as a matter of fact. But then they could draw. I mean, you have examples of great politicians, people like Churchill, who painted.
Exactly.
But because they had the opportunity to be able to do these other things. And you do get, you get some universities, particularly in the States, where they really encourage a doctor or a student doing other things to go into the art department. And in they make it a must that they actually have to go and do a liberal arts study. And can you imagine somebody being a surgeon, learning how to stitch and using their hands? It all works both ways, but we've gone and forgotten that.
Exactly. And, you know, there's so many things you're talking about. Like Churchill, problematic, but Churchill also said that, you know, people wanted to shut down the galleries and the concert halls. And he said during the war, but what are we fighting for?
Exactly.
Which is an amazing thing. I also think of some of the greatest plastic surgeons that came out of the First World War and Second World War. Some of the great ones who really made the difference, for especially for burn victims and so on, were sculptors and people who did sculpture with their hands and then were able to bring what they learned there.
Yeah, and who were particularly aware of the dialogue between culture, material and performing.
Yes, yes. That dialogue is very interesting. I want to ask you about... You just gave a speech at convocation at the Royal College of Art. Could you tell us briefly what you talked about? What was on your mind? What did you want to tell?
I think what I did tell and what I wanted to tell was the importance of being given a platform, being given, you know, and creating an equitable society and creating opportunities for everybody. Whatever background they came from, and allowing those people in those various opportunities to flourish.
Yeah.
And I think education is well beyond just a rote system where you think people should learn maths through a repeating two times table and or an artist in particular, just drawing. I think, you know, being able to do all these other things, being given the opportunities to do that.
Yes.
It's very important, but also what I was emphasizing to students is that they live in a world and environment with technologies that we didn't have, so they are able to reach the rest of the world in a much more direct, indirect way that we didn't in 1982 when I graduated. I don't think I had touched a computer. And you know, the fact that in 2021, we still have issues with equality.
And
we live in an environment that is becoming more segregated in all ways, in social structure, but in race, we're becoming more insular rather than being expansive.
I remember being shocked. You know, I came up out of South Africa thinking Nelson Mandela had been liberated and apartheid had been overcome. And I was in London again thinking, well, you know, that's been done. And that lasted for, you know, not very long at all when suddenly I realized that that's not a one and done thing. It's something that has to be tackled on a daily basis in our lives. Speaking as a white male, if you know, there's a lot that we have to deal with in terms of privilege and also how you can keep things open for other people. And I think that's part of the book, one of the reasons for writing the book is this need for openness. And curiosity breeds openness and requires openness. And the digital realm can be very narrow. And I long to create a world in which we learn to keep things more open.
Yeah. And the other thing that I reminded them is, you know, sort of a Royal College of Art graduates, we shouldn't have to wait for a pandemic or Black Lives Matter movement to redress all those inequalities, to start campaigning, to start being interested in the world we live in and in humanity. That the fact that we make things, the fact that we innovate things, we discover through innovation and through practice of making, we should be able to really to minimize or to completely get rid of these segregated silos we are now building for ourselves.
They come out of fear. They come out of and also not being engaged in the real world. The thing about making I love is that it engages us with the real.
But I can't remember who, you know, of the philosophers, and I used to read a lot more than I do, but I can remember sort of people talking about education meaning different things, but education being a tool, a vehicle that increases your knowledge and makes you aware. And I think growing up in a colonial Kenya, one of the things that I used to hear a lot of is the reason why the colonial government did not want the natives, as it were, to be educated is that they will know. They will have the knowledge. And when you have knowledge, it's like, you know, the introduction of paperbacks and Penguin and Heinemann and Hamlin, you know, sort of all these books enabled a lot of people in the colonial and former empires to be able to gain an insight in who they were, but why they were in the predicament and condition that was enforced, a slave sort of enforced environment. And once people had that knowledge, they started rebelling. And the rebellion led to so-called, you know, fears of the ruler because they were losing the empire.
Well, it's well and truly lost now. I mean, there's no doubt.
Well, I think that they're somewhat trying to recreate it.
Well, best of luck, because, you know, there are a lot of people out there who have long memories in terms of how they may have been treated under empire.
Yeah.
And it doesn't translate to trade deals very easily. But I don't want to get too political, but it's very obvious. But yet there's so much to be proud of in this country. I mean, Britain. You know, when I think of the London School of Economics, and I think of how it was set up to enable women to come to university. You know, before, this is 1880s, the work of H.G. Wells, the work of Gandhi, the work of the theosophists, the work of, you know, that entire Krishnamurti, and then Sylvia Pankhurst, of course,
they
created a university where women could now get doctorates, and that spread around the world. I mean, that's an amazing legacy.
Yeah, and I think UCL did that too.
UCL too, exactly. And incredible, and so much to be proud of. And I hope we continue to find the great things that we've done in the world, as well as the not so great things, and deal with all of them. Because, as you say, openness is so important.
Well, it is. I just add that it is important to recognize that, and I just want to add, perhaps this is why, you know, some of us found ourselves here in this country rather than choosing to go elsewhere.
Yeah. Your pots are so beautiful. The forms are really move me, actually,
I have to say.
Because they tell so many stories, and they react with us and with our story, and then we bring our story to bear. And it's wonderful to hear you talk about pots, but also the way you talk about them and as containers and as mythical objects that are so much a part of what it means to be human. You were talking about, you know, the African approach to the ancestors who are present and are in dialogue with us. I go to Greece a lot. When in the villages, and there are very ancient relationships to the ancestors, which are come from the East, and those ideas are all over the world. You know, you go to Asia, you go to South America, you find these connections with our ancestors present in so many cultures, and in many respects, it's only this small part of Western Europe that seems to have negated that in some way. What do you think is going on there?
I think you mention Greece and that area. It's an area that I explored a lot because if you look at their ancient and early Cypriot or Greek pottery, but also the Mediterranean sort of Egypt, and you go up the Nile or down the Nile, you find the Karma pots from Sudan, which were the finest pieces made. Yes. And you can see them on hieroglyphics, but you can see them on paintings in the tombs in Egypt, because these, you know, I'm absolutely sure that some of the potters came from that particular part of the world into Egypt to be potters. You see the hieroglyphics, the potters are usually a different people than the Egyptians. So you know that the potters may have come from the south rather than from Egypt itself. But, you know, those early ancient pots or vessels and containers are very, very animated. They're almost cartoon-like. They're vehicles of telling stories, because they have appendages. They have these drawings and these marks on them that are like messages or like identity manifestation of the people who are making them, but also the culture that they were coming from. There's so much you can read from pots from antiquity, and that goes from all over the world. I mean, if you mention Southwest Coast America, the ancient world in South America, ancient Chinese, the early Jomon pieces from Japan, but the earliest pots that you find from East Africa all have, there's a need for human beings to at the same time painting in caves, making those marks that are on caves, transferring them into their vessel making and object making. So you, here and there, you find a geometrical form that corresponds to a form that, you know, X mark might have been made on a cave to give a message to the next people who came there. And pottery has this ability to be able to to apply decoration, but also messages.
Yes.
From one to the other. You know, when people from north sort of Rift Valley part of Kenya go from one area to, they are nomadic group of people. Yes. When they go from one wedding to another, or from home to a wedding, they make these, they used to have these pots made, which were then covered with skin and hide.
Yes.
And that grew, became another skin, not a glaze, but it did exactly the same thing. It rendered the pot or the vessel non-porous, so you could carry the beer or the water on the sides of a camel to take to the other community where you're going to meet. But these pieces were very, if you look at them now in the museum, National Museum of Kenya, Nairobi, without knowing, they are just very sculptured pieces. They've got handles and ears
and they're beautiful.
And lips, and they're very, very beautiful. The fact that they can you can tell a story by just looking at a pot is really very important. But what I really like is this ability to transform, to transit.
Yes, they allow us to take things and to move and to connect with each other.
Yes.
I mean, I was, when you're talking, I'm thinking, what an astonishing moment it must have been in human civilization when we start to, over time, realize that this clay mixture can be baked in the sun or even in the fire, but it can be formed so that it can hold stuff. And because it can hold stuff, we can go over there and take stuff to our friends over there in some way.
But we can cook it on a fire. We can cook things
in it
on a fire.
And it's amazing.
It is amazing. It is such, and I think, I'm going to be selfish enough to say, ceramics and pottery is the only media and material that can do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's basket weaving, but it's porous. That's the problem.
Basket weaving is porous and it doesn't last as long.
Yes, that's right.
You tend to find it in little bits and pieces.
You know, I could speak with you all day. It's such a pleasure to talk with you, I have to say. We're running out of time. But it's so wonderful to talk with you, Magdalena. I want to ask you, if there was one thing that you want to leave our listeners or young people, or what's the one message that you would seek to give?
I think, you know, to remember to make, to be engaged in cultural practice and to be engaged in dialogue through arts and through a making, and recreate this humanity that is embedded in one vessel that one makes. And I think the love of pursuit for perfection and for simplicity in what we do, so that, you know, sort of universally we can participate in this cultural world of talking, making, and creating a history that is everlasting, I think. I'm trying to be clever here, but I think simply, just making work is, you know, sort of akin to a surgeon healing me.
Yes.
And using a container to contain all that potentially healing material in that container.
Dame Magdalena Odundo, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight, a pleasure, and insightful. Really.
Garrick, grateful. It's been wonderful to be invited. I was very nervous. I didn't know we would have a conversation while we were talking, but it's been wonderful. And your mind and line of inquiry, your interest has been revealing and something to think about when we finish.
Thank here. You so much.
It will continue.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why you thought this was so. We always appreciate hearing from our listeners and having a curious conversation. Join today at hashtag Curious Advantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon and in bookshops near you. Order your copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.